Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. It's my pleasure to welcome you here today on behalf of University College of Syracuse University. Thanks for coming out on this first Thursday of March. I want to give you a heads up about the next couple of weeks at TMR. You'll be getting seeing a full schedule for March up very soon. But next week we're going to be speaking with Tom Keck, who's a professor at the Maxwell School. He's the Michael O. Sawyer Professor of Constitutional Law. He's going to be talking about SCOTUS, that is the Supreme Court of the United States, and the 2012 presidential election. As you may know, there are several really landmark cases before the Supreme Court this term, including the health care constitutionality, immigration questions, the Arizona case, and I think it's a Texas redistricting case that's still up, all of which are very, not so much your usual docket. So Professor Keck, who's been here before, when you see him, I think you'll remember him. He's a great speaker. The following week, we are going to be having the program on McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Center with Julie Cecil that we had postponed from an earlier date. So that's the following week, March 15th. So that's the next couple of weeks. I wanted to thank Andy Major of the Syracuse Peace Council, who's going to be introducing Colonel Wright this morning, for suggesting this program and arranging it for us. And when Andy mentioned it, I thought, well, you know, Colonel Wright was here. This group was protesting at Hancock, talking about the drones. We really ought to find out what's going on at Hancock with the drones. So you might remember that in early February, we had Colonel Bradley, the wing commander, scheduled. And he and our friend Jeff Brown, former TMR member who's a communications director there, were very eager to have him come and talk about it. But those above in Washington, D.C. said that that wasn't on the docket. So then national security and all that kind of stuff. Well, not so much national security, but the security, I guess, of the pilots. So we're going to have to rely on today to get our story, or what we can gather from news as far as that side of the story with what's going on at Hancock. But anyway, again, thank you, Andy, and welcome.
Good morning. Wonderful to be here. Before I introduce Colonel Wright, I thought I should acknowledge a dear friend who is a regular Thursday morning roundtable person who would have been delighted about this morning's event. That's Frank Woolover, who passed away and is someone who's deeply missed in the community here. When people think about democracy, we tend to think about primary campaigns, especially this season right now, about election campaigns, about voting. But without accurate information and without meaningful choices among candidates, democracy can become an empty ritual. One important source of information is from people who have worked inside of various systems, who have seen the failings of those systems and chosen to speak out and share that insider information. Colonel Ann Wright is one of those brave people. A former Army colonel, a retired State Department official, Anne resigned in protest of the U.S. war against Iraq in 2003. Since that time, Anne has devoted herself to standing up for the ideals that we claim as a nation. Not being satisfied with simply professing those ideals, Anne has traveled extensively, supporting movements for peace and social justice, both here around the United States and around the world. Some of those actions have included joining with Cindy Sheehan to organize Camp Casey demonstrations outside of George W. Bush's Texas ranch in the summer of 2005. That fall, for the first time, she was arrested protesting outside of the White House, protesting the Iraq War. And in June 2010, Anne participated in the humanitarian flotilla to Gaza, seeking to break the Israeli blockade on that beleaguered territory. And as Sandra mentioned, on April 22nd of last year, Ann came here to Syracuse to participate in an anti-war demonstration at Hancock Airfield, calling for an end to the wars and a halt to the use of drones in warfare. She was one of 38 people who was arrested for dying in at the entrance to the base, and Ann actually came in support of the action, not expecting that she would risk arrest, but was moved by the witness of those who chose to push things a little further and joined in at the last moment. Last night in DeWitt Town Court, Ann was sentenced by Judge Gideon to a fine of $375 and a year of conditional discharge. She's the author of a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, which is available for sale outside, and she'd be delighted to sign it for you after this morning's program. So please join me in giving a warm Syracuse welcome to Colonel Ann Wright.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here in Syracuse. My apologies for kind of hobbling up here. I am the lucky recipient of a new hip, 2 months into a hip replacement, so I'm still kind of wobbling around a little bit. It's in wobbling around on the weather, too. I mean, I'm from Honolulu, Hawaii, and let me tell you what, coming from Hawaii after 2 months with this hip replacement, some people are saying, are you an idiot? Good God, you ought to stay in Honolulu. You know, you're not going to slip on ice there. And was like, well, I got to go. The judge is calling. Judge Gideon is calling on February 29th. I've got to be there for my sentencing of my latest round of dissent, along with the 37 other people that were here, friends and neighbors of your all's, about this issue of the drones. But before I start talking about drones, what I'd like to do is give you a little bit more background of where I'm coming from on this. And as Andy mentioned, I've spent most of my adult life as a U.S. government employee. I worked in the military. I was in the military for 29 years, 13 on active duty, 16 in the reserves. I retired as a colonel long time ago, in 1996, I retired after 29 years. I also was in the U.S. Department of State as a U.S. diplomat and served in U.S. embassies in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone, Micronesia. I helped reopen the U.S. embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2001 and stayed there almost 6 months, and then went on to what was to become my final assignment, which was as the Deputy Ambassador, and in fact, I've been Deputy Ambassador in the last four assignments to the U.S. Embassy, or with the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. As you can tell from that, you know, the places I served, it wasn't like I was doing Paris, Rome, and London. And I didn't want to. I wanted to go to see where U.S. policies were on the edge. And a lot of on the edge was because a lot of the policies the American public didn't agree with. And if you think about the Central America back in the 1980s, and I was in Nicaragua, I was in Grenada, the invasion of Grenada first as a military officer, and then 7 years later as a U.S. diplomat. I was in Somalia. I was there for 4 months and left right before U.S. forces, 17 of them, were killed in Somalia in what we now know as Black Hawk Down. I was pulled out of training by the Secretary of State and then sent back to Somalia, working with the United Nations and the Justice Program there and trying to, as we had been doing for the previous 6 months, trying to reconstruct the Somali police system, judicial system, and prison system in a land that had no government. And if you look now, 20 years later, at Somalia, where the U.S. is using drones to kill Somalis on one side or the other, that place is in a very difficult position. I resigned in 2003 after nearly 40 years and being in the U.S. government. and through some very contentious times and policies that I didn't resign over. But it was the decision of the Bush administration to invade and occupy an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had not attacked the United States and that had nothing to do with 9/11. There were no Iraqis that were involved at all with the incidents of 9/11. In fact, there were no Afghans that had anything to do with that 9/11 other than providing a training location that al-Qaeda used. But it was that decision of the Bush administration to focus on Iraq, and I having just come from Afghanistan, seeing what was going on there and thinking, you know, if the United States really intends to kind of have some programs that might help a beleaguered citizenry that had been under war at that time for 25 years, starting with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and 10 years later, the Soviets leaving, mainly because Afghan freedom fighters, we called them the Mujahideen then, had been supplied by the West, mostly the United States, with Stinger missiles that were shooting down Soviet helicopters. And after the Soviets left in 1989, the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, took the weapons that we and others had given them. Also international fighters, to include a man by the name of Osama bin Laden, who had come from Saudi Arabia to be with fighters from the Arab world's, Arab world that were kicking out a foreign invader in another Muslim country. Having been in Afghanistan and seeing that window of opportunity to maybe help the people of Afghanistan that wanted to have peace in their country, not that you get peace necessarily by invading their country, but maybe there was that window of opportunity that maybe there would be some quiet. Al-Qaeda had moved out of Afghanistan, was in Pakistan. The Taliban were kind of pushed away, and there was a window of opportunity for health, education, roads, but instead the focus of the U.S. government moved very quickly from Afghanistan to invading and occupying Iraq. And that's where I said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And I became one of three federal employees that resigned over the Iraq War. Not a lot, only three. We all happened to be in the diplomatic corps. We didn't know each other. Brady Kiesling was our political counselor in our U.S. embassy in Athens, Greece. John Brown was on a special assignment with Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And I was all the way out in Mongolia. I mean, it's about as far out in the world as you could get. And people were going, well, boy, that's really important. You were really serving in a very important strategic interest place of the United States of America, aren't you? So, I mean, is it? Is Mongolia a strategic place? Well, yeah, come on, let's say yes. Every place is strategic. Make me feel better. No, but the point is that when there are resignations in our government, do they mean anything? Do they really mean anything? Is it important to our government? Well, I would say to the senior leadership, the political leadership of our government, those resignations in this case meant nothing. It meant nothing. The three of us were blowing in the wind, as were the millions of Americans and millions of people all over the world that were out on the street saying to the Bush administration and the Blair administration back in the fall of 2002, the spring of 2003, don't invade and occupy Iraq. The biggest mobilizations of citizen activism in the history of the world happened in the fall of 2002 and the spring of 2003. The UN Security Council met. Colin Powell, our Secretary of Defense, our Secretary of State, my boss, gave this lengthy appeal to the UN Security Council about those weapons of mass destruction in Iraq being a threat to international security. How many of you all watched it on TV? Other than the Super Bowl that year, probably that broadcast was probably watched by more people in America and certainly more people in the world about what the United States was going to say about those weapons of mass destruction. Gosh, and it was so powerful, and it was so accurate. that what happened in the UN Security Council? Well, it wasn't Akron, and it wasn't believable, and the UN Security Council refused to authorize war on behalf of the international community, and what happened? We went anyway. And 8 years later, now the beginning of 9 years, the United States combat troops are out. We no longer have a huge military presence. In fact, we're not supposed to have a military presence, but I would suspect, with my 40 years of service in our government, I suspect we probably still have a few military in there. We certainly have the largest embassy in the world. Over 17,000 people are a part of an embassy with the biggest landmass, so big that you have to have drones surveilling it. We have U.S. State Department drones now. And that will lead me into the next part of my presentation, which is something right here in your own community, drones. Drones. Here in Syracuse, New York, at Hancock Air Force Base, you have young men and women and old men and women who are part of a network in our military, and also not here in Hancock, but in our U.S. government, we also have operators that are in other government agencies, the CIA. But here in Hancock, you have our U.S. military that are operating drones all the way, 7,000 miles away, that are in Afghanistan. And as Susan mentioned, that you all had asked if the commander of the airbase could come here and talk to you about drones, and I would suggest that you appeal again. I would put in a request every month to the Department of Defense to say the citizens of Hancock, the citizens of Syracuse, should be knowing about these drones. They should know what the good, the bad, and the ugly are, because the drones being flown from here makes your community a target. It makes the communities from whence all of these drones are flown in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, although they are not flown from here, but the blowback from others being flown from other places into Pakistan could come to haunt you here. The drones in Somalia, the drones in Yemen, and where we now have 3 American citizens that have been assassinated by these drones. You know, the issue of drones and just the military out here and just, well, they're just flying a little computer game and they're firing Hellfire missiles in Afghanistan and gosh, yeah, but they're killing people there. We know that, but, you know, those people must be deserving of death. I mean, we have to believe our government in this. I mean, our government wouldn't be intentionally killing people unless they really deserved it. And yet, when you look at the statistics, there are a heck of a lot of people who seem to be young children, who seem to be women, who seem to be old men in wheelchairs, that indeed the targeting of our drones is not so good. There are people who have been killed by these drones that no doubt have had, that were not, how to say it, they challenged U.S. interests in their area. They challenged the occupiers, the invaders of their country. And, you know, we've got our own view of why we went into Afghanistan. I thought it was to go after Al-Qaeda, the ones that our government says that are the perpetrators of 9/11. But then you look at how many Al-Qaeda does our government say are in Afghanistan at any time? Our own director of the CIA says maybe anywhere from 25 to 50. Well, the Taliban, though. If the Taliban, who was the government of Afghanistan at the time, and now the Taliban were fighting us, and why should they be fighting us? I mean, we have the right to invade and occupy anybody we want to, anytime we want to, for whatever reason we want to. And if those Taliban allowed Al-Qaeda to be in Afghanistan, then we tough noogies. You know, we can go after you anytime we want to. And that's what we've been doing. But how many Taliban are there? Well, there must be a billion of them. I mean, look at the billions we've spent on invading and occupying and staying in Afghanistan now for how many years? 10. Completed 10 years. So, my goodness gracious, there must be how many are there? Well, the director of the CIA says if all the Taliban who ever signed up under threat by others in the Taliban, or people in senior leadership of the Taliban saying to others in their communities, if you don't come out with us to fight the foreign invaders, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill you and we're going to kill your family. And that's where you get most of the ground fighters of the Taliban. They've been threatened by somebody. But if all of them dug up their weapons and came out to challenge U.S. and NATO forces, let's see, how many would they be? Our CIA director says on the top day there might be 15,000. So if you've got 15,000 Taliban, you've got anywhere from 25 to 50 Al-Qaeda, and then what? How many people are in the national security apparatus of Afghanistan? Well, if you look at the U.S., we've got 125,000 military. We've got probably 80,000 U.S. contractors because, you know, the privatization of our U.S. military is tremendous. The private corporations that furnish people to do military-related tasks. We have 40,000 NATO forces that are there. One of the missions of the U.S. military is to train Afghan forces, and we've trained about 150,000 people in the Afghan National Army, and we've trained about 125,000 that are in the Afghan National Police. When you total all those up, it's about 600,000 people in Afghanistan that are dealing with the national security issues and our national security issues, as told to us by two administrations. And what is, who are the opponents? 17,050. So we must be winning. We must be winning. Well, in this thing called asymmetrical warfare, where mighty, mighty militaries, the mightiest military in the whole world, the United States of America, is stalled. Stalled because there are pesky Afghans that are defending their territory, that are using asymmetrical warfare, that are using small little explosive devices that can blow up our big, mighty equipment. So we are now using asymmetrical warfare, and it's called the drones. It's called the drones that we can, they're inexpensive compared to the F-16s. I mean, a drone may only cost, you know, $2.3 million versus $85 million for an F-16. They're cheap. They're cheap, and they don't have, we don't have to put our men and women on the ground. We can let those drones hover for 15 hours, those Predator drones and the Reaper drones. You know, aren't the names interesting for the military? I mean, I was a part of the military, and the psychological operations that are used in naming military equipment. I mean, we name them for a purpose, to scare people. To scare people. The Hellfire missile, the Predator drone, the Reaper drone, the Grim Reaper drone. And indeed it is. It's a Grim Reaper. As it hovers and looks and looks and looks and looks. And then as 170 intel analysts per drone, per mission of the drone, are getting feedbacks from these cameras. These cameras that are almost like, I mean, they can come down on a vehicle and they can look inside the vehicle and they can see who's in there. And all these intel analysts in Afghanistan, in the United States, in Hancock Air Force Base, are looking to see who it is that we are targeting. Is that really a militant or is that not a militant? Do we know who that person is? Well, maybe we know who that person is. The to-ing and fro-ing, what are we going to do about that group of people that may be out by a that may be in a vehicle speeding along the road or in an overturned gasoline convoy, who are those people that are out there that looks like they're getting gas out of that gasoline truck that's turned over? Why are they doing that? Well, it may be, maybe they're going to use that gasoline against us, and all of a sudden the decision's made that we have to take them out, and we take them out, and then we find out with the whole convoy there explodes, gasoline everywhere, 30 people killed, and as the investigation's done later, how many of those are militants? In that case, none of them were. If you look at the CIA over in Pakistan, the CIA, an agency of our government that's not a military group, does not wear a uniform, is operating an undeclared operation in Pakistan, is killing Pakistanis and Afghans in Pakistan. if you really look by international law, the CIA is, by estimations of people generally not in the United States, because we hate to say this word about our own actions, but by the thoughts of people around the world, what would an ununiformed group that is killing people in another country, what would that group be called by us? Terrorists? Well, that's exactly what the CIA is called in Pakistan, in no uncertain terms. In fact, there are two lawsuits against the CIA right now. The station chief and the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad has had to leave the country because of the lawsuits. And why are the Pakistanis concerned? I mean, the latest incident was 24 Pakistani soldiers that were killed by a CIA drone in a mistake. It's the mistakes. The mistakes that have caused Pakistan to be in turmoil, where NATO and U.S. convoys that go from the port of Karachi, the seaport, bringing all of these millions, billions of dollars of supplies that it takes to support a massive military operation in Afghanistan, a landlocked country, where to get 1 gallon of gasoline into Afghanistan, the cost is about $100 per gallon of gas to get it in. So what happened in Pakistan? Between the killing of 24 soldiers, and we apologize, we do. Our president apologizes, our secretary of defense apologizes, everybody apologizes. But I'll tell you what, those apologies don't go very far for those 24 families or for the hundreds, thousands. You know, 10 years ago we had 50 drones in our U.S. government inventory. Now we have 7,000 drones, 7,000 drones. Under the Obama administration, the numbers of drones that are being used and the numbers of fatalities from those drones, including what we call militants and then collateral damage, those civilians that, oops, they were there, sorry. The deaths now in Pakistan range anywhere, and there are three different sources. They range anywhere from 2,500 to 3,500. Pakistan has closed down an entire logistics route because of these deaths. If you look in Afghanistan, Afghanistan in turmoil right now. I mean, apparently last night or during the day in Afghanistan, more U.S. soldiers have been killed because of Afghan outrage because of the burning of the Quran. The insensitivity of certain members of our military or whatever government agency it was that sent these two people with bags of books, as the bags of books were being dumped into an incinerator in Bagram Air Base, and the Afghans who do the dirty work for the American presence there, who are the ones that burn the excrements, that burn the trash, that burn the computers, and then these guys were there at the incineration pit pulling around everything to make it burn, and the books fell in, and the Afghans saw that these were not just books, these were the Holy Quran, and they jumped into the fire to pull the holy book out, and some of them put some of the burned copies of it into their jackets and took them out of Bagram Air Base and showed people in Bagram the holy books that had been burned. And now we're in the second week of the outrage of Afghans. Similar to what would happen here, I think, in the United States. I mean, people are very sensitive to their religious books, whether it's the Bible, whether it's the Quran, whether it's the Torah. And when foreigners, what seems to be purposefully, start desecrating these types of very symbolic objects, things happen. We now have two American military officers who were executed in one of the most secure areas in Kabul, in the Ministry of the Interior, inside many sets of locked doors. Those military officers were working with the Afghan military to coordinate operations that were going on in Afghanistan. And the story goes that this young Afghan police officer who had access to all of this and who was outraged about about the burning of the Koran came into this very secure facility and point blank executed with numerous shots two American officers. Well, it's a horrible thing, and it's a horrible thing when we the United States, execute people. We execute people. We execute them from afar. We execute them from Hancock Air Force Base. We execute them from Creech Air Force Base. The blowback of these types of things, the blowback of U.S. military people being killed in Afghanistan, you could say, well, that was just about the Koran. But we have other, we have direct incidents that have happened about the drones. We have, and I'll end on this one, we have the incident of a Jordanian doctor who was recruited by the CIA, recruited because they felt he could probably infiltrate into some elements of Al-Qaeda, that he had the proper credentials. He was from Jordan. They could make up whatever they needed to. And, you know, they asked him if he would please go out and help us get more information about Al-Qaeda, and he did. And over a period of a year, he was moving back and forth, getting information. And then he let his handlers know in Afghanistan at a CIA base in Afghanistan. He let them know that he had some very special information for them. And they were thrilled to be able, the doctors coming back to our base, and the eight key people in our Al-Qaeda watch. These people have been watching Al-Qaeda first from Washington for years and years and years, and then a group of them had been deployed to the CIA base in Afghanistan. And they were there, the doctors coming to us, and they told the guys at the gate, don't worry about him, he's one of us. He's one of our senior people. They didn't tell the guard that. They just said, when the doctor comes, let him in. So they came out of their hardened headquarters and met the doctor in the parking lot, and the doctor blew himself up, killed all eight of them, our senior people in our government that knew the most about Al-Qaeda. And why did he blow himself up, and purposely right there so he would blow up a lot of our CIA? In a letter that he left with his wife in Jordan, it was the drones. It was the killing of innocent civilians by these drones. So one can always argue, well, it's no different from F-16s flying above. It's no different from, shelling them with artillery. You know, there's always collateral damage as the military itself, and the dehumanization of people that we consider our enemies. You know, in the Vietnam War, we called them the gooks. We call them ragheads now. And in the drone terminology, there's a new one. The ones that we kill are called bug splat. They're the bug splat. The ones that get away are called the squirters. So I would submit to you as fellow citizens that we need to know more about these drones. We need to know more about them because they're coming to us. Not only are they being operated from your community in Afghanistan, but there are drones that will be flying in our airspace here. Just last week, the FAA was ordered by the Congress to open up airspace by the year 2016 for up to 30,000 drones that will be flying in the United States in commercial airspace. And in fact, in the next 6 months, they have to designate six areas in the U.S. that will be used as training areas where drones will be integrated into the commercial airspace to see how well they do, to see if indeed by operating from the ground, whether they can, I guess, not run into anything that's operated by humans in the air. And we know they need to practice that because there was a drone that ran into a C-130 in Afghanistan. The drone blew up. The C-130 had to make an emergency landing. We know there have been something like 30 drones that have gone out of control, including, one of them that somehow ended up in Iran that the Iranians suddenly found in their hands. So these drones are coming. It's the wave of the future. The military is training now more drone operators than it is fixed-wing pilots. These are our future, and I would hope that this wonderful thing, Thursday Morning Roundtable, will continue to make application to the base commander so that he will pass that request for his to come and talk to you up to the Department of Defense. When our government refuses to let the citizenry know what's going on, we need to be challenging them. And that's what this book, Dissent Voices of Conscience, and I'll truly end on that, is all about. Men and women of our government who have challenged our own government, who have said, listen, I'm in it, and I see something that's going on here that isn't right. It's, you know, people are bending the rules, or maybe they're breaking the rules, or maybe there are even criminal activities going on. The whistleblowers, men and women of our military and the civilian part of our government that have taken the stance, and a very difficult stance, of saying to our government, you know, you need to do better, and I know how to help you do better, and let me help you do better. And then the good and the bad and the ugly of what happens to them. And generally, it's not good. We now have 6 whistleblowers. The Obama administration is prosecuting more whistleblowers, double the number that were. I mean, are you supposed to prosecute whistleblowers? I thought they had protection. But that's not it. That's not it now. 6 whistleblowers are being prosecuted, and 3 of the 6 are being charged with espionage. That indeed classified information has been given out as they are trying to tell first the government itself that something's going wrong. But instead of saying, gosh, thanks for letting us know, we got to fix this, it's the whistleblowers that are being prosecuted. So I hope that you all have good success in getting that colonel who I would suspect would like to let you all know what's going on in your community. It's the big boys and girls of politicians in Washington that don't really want to let us peek into this. So with that, let me thank you so very much for your kindness in inviting me here, and good luck in Hancock, and for me, I say, let's stop the drones. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Wright.
Thank you so much. As a citizen of Syracuse in the United States, I appreciate you coming to our community and sharing with us what's going on. We can see a piece of it, but we really don't know the full story. When you were speaking, I was thinking initially of the United States dropping the atomic bomb in Japan. And since then, we have been attempting to keep atomic bombs out of warfare. But they are a threat to us. They're a threat to the world. I think that the drones are exactly the same. But the question that I have, how do you think that we can close down the operation in Afghanistan in a way that will be safe for the men and women that are serving there from the United States, and also be safe for the Afghan people?
Well, an excellent point. I think for any time we get the U.S. is in a military operation and needs to get out of it, that's the big question. How do you remove yourself after get into something that some people say you shouldn't have been in the first place? Others say, okay, we tried our best to do whatever it was, whatever our intention was. How do you remove yourself and at least harm, continued harm to the people that you have been invading or occupying or whatever terminology you want to have? Afghanistan is a tough place, I'll tell you. You know, that it's the place where empires die, as the phrase goes. The Afghan people, no matter what our intent of going in there, their intent in general is to get you out of there. And they've been very successful, like 100% successful. And we're the latest ones that will be removing ourselves in the next. The Obama administration says, by the year 2014? That's only 2 years from now. And then what will happen? Well, my prediction 10 years ago when I helped reopen that embassy was that there was maybe a 20% chance that the people of Afghanistan would actually find themselves at some stage with peace in their country. The odds are stacked against them, and we help stack the odds against them. No matter what our politicians are saying that we are not doing that, what we are is equipping the same Afghans that will rape, pillage, and plunder as they did after they pushed the Soviets out, the warlords, many of whom are a part of the Karzai government, some of whom are in Pakistan and some are in Iran. They are now re-equipped, retrained, and they have recruited more people to be a part of, it could be a tribal group or it could be just an economic powerful group. I mean, you've got the warlords that were there back in the 80s against the Soviets, and then in the 90s fighting among themselves. Some of the worst damage done in Afghanistan was done after the Soviets left, and when the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, now we call them the warlords, were fighting among themselves for territory. That's when the western part of Kabul was totally blown up by the freedom fighters. They're still there. Many of them have been in government. Fahim, Dostum, all of them. They have put their parts of the militia into the new Afghan army, so we have kindly given them new strategies, new equipment, and they can be recalled into these militias at any time. And we've seen that happen. We've seen the disappearance of units of the Afghan army when one of the warlords said, we're not going to fight the Taliban today. Come on. We've already got our deal cut with them behind the scenes. The Taliban that has been equipped by a variety of people, including the Pakistanis, who are still there, that are still a force. I mean, if you say 15,000 against 600,000, I mean, they've not done too badly against the international forces. So, unfortunately, in my prediction, the probability of there being peace and quiet in Afghanistan among Afghans after we leave is pretty low. What we are doing is just fueling the next decade of violence in that country. And I think we need to stop fueling that. And as you mentioned on atomic weapons, you know, here's a terrible, terrible weapon that the United States used twice on human beings, at least in war, and we've used it in experimental things on U.S. military soldiers in the explosions that we had in Nevada. But we and the Marshallese in the Pacific Ocean, because of international outcry about those weapons, I think that's what's prevented us from ever using one on a battlefield, a tactical nuclear weapon. The United States knows that it's going to be big trouble if you use that, and we haven't. And that's where I think we really need to be going with these drones, that while there are a weapon system that certainly can be used, we can see that the blowback already from this, what one might call just a modest little weapon system, is so intense that, and it's so easily usable on us. It'd be very easy for anybody that says, you want a drone? You know, there's an article in one of the news things this morning called people who fly drones should not throw stones. And it's true. I mean, these things are easy. They are easy. Small ones can carry an impact that could damage things here in the United States. And we need to be worried about law enforcement with these drones, too. It's just not the military use of them, but law enforcement for curtailing our civil liberties, for going after our civil liberties, for surveilling us without a warrant. They make little drones that are the size of, they call them hummingbirds. They're little bitty, bitty things that can be flown in your window. They can sit on the top of your refrigerator. They can just have a little camera. Yeah, Anne Wright, the critic of U.S. policies, let's just see where she is today and what's going on. They fly that little drone in and it sits there and then maybe follows me down the stairway into my basement, although I don't have one in Hawaii. But, you know, you can... I don't want to think badly of our government, but we've certainly seen many times that our government and some of its officials have overreached, that perhaps they have bent the law just a little bit, you know, for the purposes that they will say, well, it's our national security.
Are there other countries that are using or that have and or are using unmanned drones with weaponry?
Yes, indeed. In fact, Israel uses drones. They have a 24-hour drone presence over Gaza. And in fact, they use the Hellfire missiles. Actually, it's not Hellfire. They have their own missile system on their drones. And it arguably is one of the reasons why there are militants in Gaza that fire rockets back in Israel. And thank God, most of them don't hit anything. And I wish they wouldn't. I wish they wouldn't use those at all. It doesn't help their cause any. But the Israelis use drones all the time for surveillance, 24 hours a day, and then for specific attacks on specific people they want to assassinate.
Does the U.S. have any policy of restitution for the 3,000 or so civilians, innocents that have been killed in the areas that you've talked about?
Well, the U.S. military, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, have had a process where Iraqis and Afghans can appeal to the military unit in their area for restitution. As one can imagine, it is a very lengthy process. It is a very dangerous process of people going even to a military base to say, you know, you kill my mother, you kill my sister, my brother. And I doubt if many people are doing this with the drones right now, because you can read in the newspapers, our American newspapers are reporting that one of the tactics that our military and the CIA are both using is that after they target a home that they think a militant, someone of interest is in there that they want to kill, they blow up that house, and then as the villagers of that area come to see what happened, see, who's in there, is there anybody alive, the second rocket from the drone is purposely held back so that it will kill the people that come to help the survivors. In Pakistan, as people are being killed, people of interest are killed, and funerals are held for them, usually within 24 hours, we now have a tactic that we will put a missile into the funeral party. And you can read the newspaper, U.S. newspaper reports of this, saying this is a new tactic that the United States is using. The CIA doesn't compensate anyone for anything because it's secret. We don't know about it. So the 2,500 to 3,000 people that have been killed in Pakistan have no recourse at all because it didn't happen to them, I guess.
I just read an article that a realtor, and I can't remember where he lives, somewhere in the United States, purchased or is in the process, I think he's already purchased a drone, and the purpose is to fly over properties that he is selling to do aerial shots for customers. What I want to know is, do you have any sense of how difficult or easy it is for a private individual to purchase a drone? And because I would assume that we might have a little concern about some people doing that.
Well, you mean you didn't purchase one at Christmas? I mean, you could have. You could have gone down to Brookstone. You know, Brookstone, the one that has massage things and like that. It's in every airport. Well, they were selling drones at Christmas. They were small ones. The biggest that they were selling was about this big. Drones are everywhere. There are 475 companies in the United States that are making either specific drones or parts for drones. Realtors want to use them to fly over territory. Farmers want to use them to see so that they won't have to drive their pickup trucks, 20 acres away to see how the wheat's growing. The cattlemen, I guess there are not going to be any cowboys left in the world, because the cattlemen say, forget these horses, we'll just fly a drone over, go find the cows, and I guess they're going to be the aerial cowboys. I'll bet you they'll figure out how to get those drones to goose the cows to go to wherever they want to go. There are commercial purposes for sure for these drones, and law enforcement says, why should we spend $50,000 in buying a new patrol car when we can buy a commercial drone, that's maybe 6 feet long for maybe $20,000? And in fact, the city of Houston, Texas, well, they've spent more than a patrol car. They have a drone now that they can, it doesn't yet have, mortars on it, and it doesn't have tear gas canisters that it can shoot yet, but it is built so that these things can be attached to it. The city of Miami has its own drone. and check and see your city council. I mean, who knows what your city council has done? Oh, do you have a city council person here? Yay! Do you all have any drones in the works?
I think we should ask the sheriff, though.
Yeah. Is the sheriff here? No, but it's something that every community ought to be asking, because, I mean, it is the wave of the future. This is happening. And when you have the U.S. Congress, you know, that's bought off by everybody, the lobbyists that are in there, can you imagine what it took for the U.S. Congress last week to have passed a law that says to the FAA, you've only got 6 months to figure this thing out, that you have to designate six areas, and one of them, I can guarantee you, is right up here, the Adirondack National Park, which your Senator Chuck Schumer has been lobbying for the last 6 months, that be designated as an area that drones from Fort Drum could be flown over. But you can be guaranteed that will now be a place where the interaction between commercial drones and military drones and commercial aircraft is going to take place. I just came back from Missouri. I was on a speaking tour there, and they have drones flown from Whiteman Air Force Base, and they have what's called the Ozark National Forest. And probably they were thinking that's probably going to be one of the places in the Midwest that will be designated for it. Commercial air pilots, as you can well imagine, are having a fit. I mean, what are going to be the qualifications of a drone operator? Right now, the military does not have the drone operators get quite a bit of training, but not as much as a fixed-wing aircraft person. And do they actually, I mean, are there rules of flight? Probably in Afghanistan and Iraq, we do what we want to do. It doesn't really matter. Here, where there are specific rules of how commercial aircraft and military aircraft are integrated in our airspace, and then you have, how many of you all like to operate drones? I want to do that. You know, yeah, I mean, any of us could do that. We can do it right now if it's under 400 feet, and if it's line of sight, you can get a waiver for the FAA to fly any size drone you want to under 400 feet. But when it goes over that, then into that commercial airspace that we'll be flying in as I fly down to Washington today. I mean, look outside and see this little drone coming along beside you. The Airline Pilots Association, of course, is going to make sure that these things don't get up there unless the Congress changes the rules on that. You know, here they're pushing at the FAA to do a very fast move on us to allow those drones to be up in commercial airspace.
What does your T-shirt say?
Oh, well, this one, I mean, the way I speak around the country, you never lose an opportunity to, you know, have something that someone can read, which irritates my sister to death. She and I don't agree politically. And so every T-shirt I have just irritates her. But this one today says, "Stay human." And the one I had on yesterday says, "We will not be silent."
Thank you. I have a question for you as I move across the room. Military intelligence, if you can answer this. Your boss at the time, as you said, Secretary of State Powell, testified before the UN, weapons of mass destruction, blah, 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 was turned down for, we went ahead and did it, but our information was inaccurate. Do you believe that he knew it was inaccurate, and if indeed he did not know that it was inaccurate, what does that say about our military intelligence? It says it's pretty bad. Has it gotten better?
Well, first I would say, of all people, Colin Powell, whom I respected as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but you know, he was the National Deputy Security Advisor in the Reagan administration, then the National Security Advisor under the Reagan administration while George Bush the First was Vice President, and during the period where we now know that President Reagan was not cooking on all cylinders. So I think the Vice President had a lot of influence on who got appointed to senior positions in the administration. Then George H.W. Bush came in as president. He appointed Colin Powell as chairman of the Joint Chiefs for Gulf War I. then Colin Powell was out of office for 8 years, but always in touch with all of these senior people, stay in touch with think tanks, with friends of theirs in the military and the State Department. Then he came back in as Secretary of State under George W. Bush. If that man did not know the questions to ask when he finally came back in government 8 years later, to know for sure what we knew and to be able to challenge what the CIA and all the intelligence agencies were telling him. Well, actually, when you really get down to it, there were intelligence agencies that were telling our government there are no weapons of mass destruction there. But Colin Powell, as his chief of staff, retired Army Colonel Larry Wilkerson, said after Colin Powell and he came out of office in for the second administration of the Bush administration, Larry Wilkerson has been very frank and honest in public statements that you can read on the internet. You can have him come and talk to about what they knew and what they didn't know. They knew everything. They knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and what they had to do was cherry-pick the best information the CIA was feeding them to build the strongest case that there were. But Larry Wilkerson said, we knew there were none.
Thank you for your comprehensive presentation. I appreciate it. I have a comment and then a question. The comment is, if anybody here is interested in tracking the actual casualties in the war on a very accurate site, icasualties.org, casualties.org, will show you on a daily basis the human toll in detail, meaning name, rank, location of their home, the site of their death, the country of their origin, their base. Every single detail is there. I highly commend that website if you really want to see what this war costs. My question is, in a very different venue, it's about the Geneva Conventions, and I wondered what your comments might be on the meaning and value of the Geneva Conventions in the context of the last 10 years, and particularly what it means to a soldier and how they live with those conventions in this war.
Well, as a military officer, I taught the law of land warfare or the Geneva Conventions at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to the 82nd Airborne Division and to Special Operations Forces. So I've had a lot of experience with trying to analyze what we have done in past military operations and using that background in what we are involved in now. The decision of the Bush administration to go into Iraq without international authority through the UN Security Council and without an imminent threat even though the administration was trying to argue there is an imminent threat from these weapons of mass destruction. And remember, Condoleezza Rice at the time, the National Security Advisor, said, you know, we can't wait till the smoking gun is a mushroom cloud, or the other way around. You know, that we can't wait there, that there is that imminent threat. And so they were trying to use that. They knew what the law was, so they were trying to convince everyone there was that imminent threat. But when you really get down to it, and when you now know that they knew there was not this imminent threat, then it is a violation of international law. And the people around in our country and around the world who assert that the Bush administration should be held accountable for, essentially war crimes for starting a war. And then you look at all of the deaths and, you know, all of this. Well, there's a lot of people that say the Bush administration should be held accountable for that. And I am one of them. I think the Iraq or the Afghanistan war, one could argue that the decision to go into Afghanistan can be linked back to a threat that was actualized, that there was the events of 9/11, that the training grounds in Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda, that the U.S. could legitimately say we've got to go after that threat there. The Clinton administration, none of them, let's be equal opportunity critiques of all the administration. The Clinton administration sent cruise missiles into Afghanistan several different times after the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia were blown up, a U.S. military barracks in Saudi Arabia. When two U.S. embassies in East Africa were blown up, the response of the Clinton administration was to send missiles in. One could also analyze this, you know, with the benefit of 10 years now that we've been in Afghanistan, of what really is the best response when there is an attack on U.S. interests, whether they're in the U.S. or in other places. Is the heavy hand of the military the best response? And I would argue that if you really look at the numbers of people in Al-Qaeda who have kind of been wrapped up, who are now out of commission, that more of them have been wrapped up through international law enforcement now than have been killed by U.S. military operations. And the numbers of people of that are the collateral damage, the innocent civilians, are much less. There are much, I mean, by increments of thousands, much fewer people that are collateral damage when you're doing international law enforcement efforts. And while one could argue, well, you know, we've got to show them, you know, and as our Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, so famously said, I mean, why do we have a military unless we use it? You know, we've got to use that. We've got to show them. We've got to show them. And, you know, if you look at both of the parties, I mean, it's we elect politicians who want to use that military, who they may say at one stage, oh, you know, that's the last thing we'll ever use. But when you really look at it, sometimes it's the first thing that we use because we got to show them. We got to make them afraid of us. We got to have the enemy on the run, at least psychologically. But then you look at, does it work? No, it really doesn't. And how we break that cycle within our own political establishment is tough, and how we break it among our own commercial establishment, where the corporations that make a killing on the killing, that right now in this time of terrible economic trouble for our country, the companies that are making the most money are the military-industrial complex. And trying to make a profit out of peace is the thing that we really would like to be moving toward, not going out and killing lots of people and putting our government in, and not our government, us, in so tremendous debt, where we now have two wars in 10 years that have cost us, depending on what estimate you have, anywhere from $3.5 trillion to $5 trillion. So we have lots of work, I think, to do internally first. You know, what do we as individuals believe in? Do we believe in, well, it's easier just use that military? It's easier just use that drone. My God, we can control everything from 7,000 miles away. It's easy to use. Nobody of us gets killed in it. Come on, let's do it. That's the argument for the drones in military operations. But what is the blowback from it? And we see from 9/11 that it's very easy to have blowback in this country. It's easy. And I would submit that we would like to maybe have a little bit better image in the world and maybe not be invading and occupying so many countries, and that might help resolve some of the issues that other people have that in their anger and distrust of what America stands for.
Thank you, Colonel Ian Wright.